Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is not a perfect podcast, although we get as close as we can. But our focus today is on a perfect NFL season, the 1972 Dolphins. We'll get to that in just a couple of minutes.
That was my NFL game films voice, by the way. Welcome to Florida.
Very nice. Very nice. What, Ed Sable? Is that guy's name who did the NFL films for so many years? Craig's most recent column in the Florida Phoenix is going to introduce most of our listeners, because they're probably interested in ecology and conservation and things of that nature, are familiar with the term greenwashing. But for anyone who isn't, lay down a definition for greenwashing and how it relates to Ron DeSantis for us.
Well, I argue in the column that, you know, the governor was in his second inauguration speech was bragging about all the things he'd accomplished in his first 4 years. And one of the things he said was, you know, we've made this tremendous contribution to the stewardship of our environment and so forth. And I said, well, wait a minute. We've got terrible water pollution problems. We've got terrible toxic algae blooms. We got manatees that are starving to death because all of the pollution has killed off the seagrass. How is the governor bragging about this stuff? Oh, okay, because he's pretending to be green when, of course, he's not really. And so I wrote this column suggesting that he was not a conservationist; he was more of a con man. Yeah. So.
Well, and this is, I mean, we've talked about this before, but his first term he ran, I won't say largely, but in no small measure as a conservationist. He was going to clean up the water. There have been all sorts of recommendations and opportunities for him to do that in his first 4 years. Each and every one he has either ignored or completely whiffed on or fallen short. And there's no meaningful reason to believe anything will change in episode two.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, he's gotten away with it for so long. If he can get away with it for another couple of years, he might be moving into the White House, and then we'll get to see how he does this on a national scale. And if you think Florida's bad off, wait till he's doing it for the whole country.
Yeah, perish the thought. FloridaPhoenix.com. You can check out Craig's most recent column there. And every Thursday, Craig writes something at FloridaPhoenix.com. I've started a new online venture around the travel industry, Rovology.com. I'm writing a twice monthly My Favorite Florida column there. I've got stuff on the Florida Highwaymen and American Beach. So check that out.
That's
when
great.
You get a chance. Yeah, thank you very much. This week, however, we're talking about sports. And, you know, sports is not a topic we discuss much on the podcast. And that's just sort of a conscious choice. Someone could easily do this same podcast focused on sports. When you think about the now number of professional teams, there's a 12 or 15 professional teams. In Florida, the great players who've come through Florida, Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade and, you know, Dan Marino, the college programs, particularly the football success of the Seminoles and the Gators and the Hurricanes during the 80s and 90s. But today,
I hear there's some fellow named Brady who's a big deal. I don't know about
Tom Brady now. Absolutely. Sure. World Series for the Marlins and the Rays. So there would be no shortage of sports topics if we chose to go in that direction, but we generally don't. Although today is a special case, because this is a special anniversary. The NFL playoffs are underway for the first time since 1999. I think all three NFL teams from Florida, the Dolphins, Buccaneers, and Jaguars are in the playoffs together. So it's time to talk about the NFL's only undefeated team, the 1972 Miami Dolphins, Craig, and you found someone who's just written a book about that.
Yes, that's right. And he's the perfect person to write about it, too. Marshall John Fisher was growing up in Miami while the Dolphins were marching along, scoring, victory after victory. And he looks back on that time, but also tells us what was going on with the players and the team and the coach.
Yeah, there's much more to this story than box scores and statistics. A fascinating societal backdrop, not only in Miami, but the country at large. Again, put yourself 1972. What's going on? Nixon, Watergate, all of this kind of thing. And those divisions were also present on the team, but they were able to overcome them in ways that the country couldn't. So this is much more than just a sports story or a sports episode or a sports book. Marshall John Fisher is going to tell us all about 1972, not only the Dolphins, but in Miami.
Marshall, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. This is a fascinating book about a fascinating time in Florida history. And you were there sort of as a fan, right?
Yes, I was. I was a 9-year-old kid in Miami, growing up in Miami in 1972. And that was the first year I was really on board with my dad and my brother as a big Dolphins fan. So it was a good year to begin.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. No kidding. kind of set the expectations a little high for
a little high. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One thing we ought to explain to people, I guess, is this is a team that had a perfect season, but they were not a perfect team.
Well, they were an interesting team. They were an interesting collection of characters, and a lot of them were guys that had been cast off from other teams or hadn't even been drafted in some cases, and they all came together in Miami under a great coach, Don Shula, who really turn them into the perfect team. But you're right in that a lot of these players might not have even been starters on other teams, at least initially. But under Shula, they really flourished, and they were great players, and they became great players under him.
Yeah, it's not however a laundry list of Hall of Famers like the 70s Steelers or the Cowboys or the 85 Bears or the early 90 yeah. Cowboys. It's certainly fine players. Bob Greasy was the quarterback. Larry Zonka. Yeah. Running back Jim Kick, Manny Fernandez, Mercury Morris. I mean, there are some names on this team, but surely the most prominent of them in football history context is the head coach, Don Shula, an absolute Hall of Famer, first head coach, maybe the only still in the NFL with 300 wins. So again, not exactly ragtag, but also this was by no means just by the names on the uniforms, a team that was supposed to, and you know, be the only team in NFL history ever to go undefeated.
That's true, but I do think a lot of those players were underrated. I mean, they were great players. You know, the team were the number one offense and the number one defense, wow. Both in points and yards. Players who you might not even think about, like Curtis Johnson and Doug Swift. These guys, they were excellent players. You know, Doug Swift came out of Amherst College, Division III. He was just lucky to get a tryout in Miami because of the strike that was going on. He became their starting linebacker his whole career. So it was just in a confluence of all these interesting characters who, even though some of them may not be remembered by many people, they were, in fact, great players, I think.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And you mentioned in the book that, you know, some of these names are names that we still know mm-hmm. today, like Bob Greasy, but Greasy was out after what, the fifth game of the season?
Yeah, it's one of the many great stories about this team is that, you know, their all pro future Hall of Fame quarterback was knocked out in game five. That was actually the one game that my family and I got to go to. And we watched them carted out of there on a stretcher, and there was this feeling like, oh, there goes the season. But of course, Shula had brought in Earl Morrill before that season. And Earl Morrill was 38 years old. He had been Shula's backup quarterback up in Baltimore, and in fact had done the same thing up there in 68 when Johnny Unitas was hurt for the whole year. Morrill came in, took him to a 15-1 season and won the NFL championship, although that was the year they had to play another game called the Super Bowl and they had a humiliating loss. But still, Morrill was a great quarterback. He was not, and you know, people think of him as a backup, but he actually started more than half the games he played in his career. Terrific quarterback, but he was 38. He was older. He was as old as some of the coaches. He was almost as old as Shula. And he brought him in instead of retiring. He decided to take up this offer and come down to Miami. And sure enough, he had to come in and he led them to 11 straight wins. He was just terrific and a big part of the story.
Amazing. Yeah. 38 in the contemporary Tom Brady, Drew Brees NFL era of right. quarterbacks doesn't sound that old. But in 1972, that would be like a 50-year-old playing today. Almost.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
That's a big difference.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. They brought in a rocking chair put up by his locker, and they, you know, I just saw a Geritol ad was up on the wall. I mean, you didn't have a lot of 38-year-olds playing, right? If I could.
And amazingly, and again, you have to go back in your memory. 1972. Again, we're just coming out of the 60s. This is mid-century America. The Dolphins were only playing in the NFL for their, I believe, fourth season and only their seventh season in existence. They were in the AFL yeah. before. That was, of course, before the merger of the AFL and the NFL, which really created yeah. the modern NFL as we know it and began with the Super Bowl, what, in 66 was the first right. Super Bowl?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So this team was really brand new. And as a state, again, not that Florida was brand new, but was really starting to you know, come into its own. But again, this is, you know, before Disney was much of a thing, or before South Beach, you know, Miami had yet to go through the mega Cuban immigration. So this is a totally different time and place.
Yes. And I talk a lot about that in my book, about the, you know, Florida back then, and Miami was just a very, very different place. It was much smaller, kind of a smaller town feel. It was thought of mostly as a vacation spot. Florida now is thought of as this training ground for sports, you know, so many great sports teams, college and pro. But back then, the Dolphins weren't just the only NFL team in Florida. They were the only major league level sports team in any sport in the whole state. So it was, and people thought that Florida wasn't a place that could support professional football. So it was a big deal when Miami got that team, and the, you know, first, of course, the first few years were a little bit rough, but you know, they were an expansion team. They weren't bad for an expansion team, although people make fun of them now, but you know, it was okay for an expansion team. And then when Shula came in 1970, everything changed, and immediately they're a playoff team, then a Super Bowl team, and then a perfect Super Bowl.
Just as a coach, and we'll get into the societal backdrop, which is probably more interesting. Just as a coach, what were his innovations? What made him so? Again, most people remember Don Shula as like this old guy. But again, 1972,
with a steakhouse.
Restaurateur. But we're going back 50 years now, and he was a young, innovative kind of whippersnapper. What made him at that time borderline revolutionary?
Yeah, well, he was. It's funny. He was a young guy. He was, you know, he was known as the Wunderkind. The young. He was the youngest NFL coach ever when he took over Baltimore in the '60s. And you know, he was an interesting guy, Shula. He always seemed like he was heading to be a coach. He was a player. He was a very good player. You know, in college, he played for a small college, John Carroll, and then got noticed by Paul Brown and was drafted by the Browns. And his home was his team he loved and grew up with. So he got to play for the Browns, and he played for the Colts as well. But he, even when he was a player, people said he was like a coach because he was interested in every aspect of the game. And he was always telling, you know, yelling at his teammates, telling them what to do. And he very quickly became a coach after his playing career. And as I say, became the youngest head coach, had great success in Baltimore, although he never went all the way. The one time he won the NFL championship, as I said, he lost the Super Bowl. But the thing about Shula, I think, was his passion for the game and his attention to detail. He was just obsessed with every little detail that he called getting him the winning edge. You know, that was the name of his memoir and the thing he always talked about. And I think that more than anything, well, that and also his ability to motivate men. He, you know, when he lost Super Bowl VI the year before the perfect season, now he had lost two Super Bowls. He was really getting to be known as the great coach who couldn't win the big one. And he became obsessed with getting back to the Super Bowl and winning it. And the thing is that he was able to do was he was able to communicate this to each and every player. And I mean, literally, he went out with the players one at a time on the plane ride home from that Super Bowl and said, remember how you feel and don't let yourself ever feel this way again. And I think maybe more than anything, he was a great motivator. And he got every guy to really get on board with his mission.
Talk a little bit about the owner of the team, Joe Robbie, who is a fascinating character in his own right. Very much a Florida guy.
Well, Joe Robbie is a great character. I mean, you know, he was an immigrant. I mean, I'm sorry, his father was an immigrant from Lebanon and to South Dakota. So he grew up in a small town in South Dakota, having to work his way through school. He became a lawyer. He became a politician in South Dakota and was in the state House of Reps, and he ran for governor. In fact, was a Democratic nominee for governor one year. But after that, he had a law practice in Minneapolis. And it was just by chance, he was in Miami Beach vacationing, and he was actually friends through his politics with the former governor of South Dakota, who was now, at this point, the commissioner of the AFL. And because of that, he got the chance to start a team because they were looking to start a team in Miami. So he said, sure. And even though he was not a wealthy man, he was just a lawyer, you know, he had a nice income, but not a huge income, and a big family to feed. But he was a real shrewd guy, and he was able to get all these investors together and to form, to pay the money that was needed. And he became an owner. And someone called him, he was the poorest owner in the NFL, you know, and one fellow owner said he ran it like a fruit stand, you know. He was notoriously frugal down to everything, including the paper clips that were purchased for the office. very frugal, although not, he was not, you know, I got to give him credit. He was willing to pay for players. He was frugal about everything. But when he, for instance, when Shula wanted Morrall, Robbie paid a good, really hefty sum to get him down here. But he was also, unfortunately, a raging alcoholic. And the stories of him passing out on the team plane and in the owner's box, and he seemed to be drunk all the time. So, but a very interesting guy. And I think he played a big part. You know, he brought Shula down. He although they didn't get along very well, he didn't interfere with football operations, and he let Shula do what he needed, and he came up with the money when needed. And I think he deserves a lot of credit.
This team is playing against a fascinating backdrop in America and in Miami as well. 1972 was the final year in which Miami would host both major political conventions, Republican and Democratic. Nixon's reelection campaign, Watergate is bubbling, Vietnam War is raging, and the book kind of details how these similar demographic divisions existed on the team, but the team was able to pull together where America seemingly pulled apart.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to do in the book, was not just about the football team and the football games, although I tried to do that in detail as well. But I wanted to work in all this other stuff that was going on in the city and in the country during that season. Miami, in some ways, was a focal point for everything that was going on in our country. As you say, both conventions being held there. Nixon was down there a lot at the Winter White House on Key Biscayne. And he was a big football fan. So he was kind of part of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Watergate investigation was just getting going, and Vietnam. So I tried to weave all these little stories into the weekly tale of each game.
Mm-hmm. And the players reflected these divisions. You know, there were new school, old school, you know, sort of line up, you know, on the microcosm of the team, yes. the sides here, so to speak.
Yeah, you have the crew cut guys like Earl Morrall. You know, he always looked like it was 1958 with his crew cut and the, kind of a conservative guy. Bob Greasy, also very conservative guy, and you had a lot of guys like that. And then you had the wild liberal guys. You know, actually not all of them were liberal politically, but the party guys, Manny Fernandez, and you know, with the long beef chop sideburns, and Jim Kick with, you know, the guys with the long mustaches and the bell bottoms. Jim Mannich was a big party guy. And a lot of them were politically liberal. A lot of the guys, people like Marv Fleming and Paul Warfield. And so you did have very different personalities, different political leanings. But the thing about this team is they never let it interfere with, they were bound together with this mission to get back to the Super Bowl and to win it. And as I say, they bought into Shula's monomania, and that overrode everything. And they, when you talk to them now, they all say the same thing, that they didn't let anything like politics or anything personal get in the way of this goal that they shared.
Yeah. Monomania. That's a good word I've never heard before, obviously a singular focus, but much less media attention, no social media. You know, the press corps for the Miami Dolphins at that point is probably, you know, a couple newspapers, maybe in a television station, as opposed to today. There's probably 20, 25 people there all the time looking for stories, poking, pressing, you know, trying to find these divisions to exploit them. So again, this is also a totally different era in American sports before salaries went bananas, before, you know, free agency went bananas, before media coverage went bananas. So, I mean, to use a horrible cliche, this is a simpler time when you could simply, as a professional athlete, focus on football and doing your job and winning games, because really, you know, to augment your salary, you needed those playoff games. This was, you know, everyone wasn't guaranteed $10 million to make a gross oversimplification. So, I mean, it was important to feed your family to win games.
It's absolutely true. You know, the top players made good salaries, you know, maybe the equivalent of $500,000 today, the best players. But of course, today, I think the minimum is probably $1 million. And a lot of the players had jobs in the offseason. It's true. And a lot of the players, it really was an incentive. The financial incentive was, as you say, big in the playoffs and the Super Bowl. A lot of them, when asked, said, we're playing. Oh, I forget who it was. One of the players said, talking about how the blacks and whites got together, got along well. And he said, you know, to us, there's no black and white. There's just green. And he was playing for the money. And you know, the playoff and Super Bowl share combined, when you put it all together, was for some players would double their salary.
Yeah.
So It was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. How, as a fan, you of course approach the story sort of feeling like you already know it, but were there things that you in your reporting that surprised you that you didn't know about this season?
Oh, definitely. One thing, as I was just a little kid then, and a lot of things I just didn't realize about Miami and the country at that time, and a lot, you know, the racism that was prevalent still was very surprising to me, how the black players really didn't want to come to Miami, a lot of them, when they were traded, because it just was not a very friendly place in some ways to black players. They weren't welcome to live in certain areas. Of course, this is post-civil rights, but not much post-civil rights. Yeah. And so even though there was no legal segregation, there was still segregation by habit.
Yeah.
And that was something I had not known much about.
Well, you talk about Joe Robbie being a first-generation immigrant. I mean, the NFL owner's portfolio today is still embarrassingly low on minority representation. Was there any backlash to, like you say, a Lebanese immigrant without huge money, a total newcomer in a newcomer city, getting one of these very few and precious franchises?
Well, Joe Robbie was not a popular man, and I don't think it was so much xenophobia or anything, but he was one reporter said he had the personality of a wharf rat, you know.
Ouch.
he was just not a well-liked person. He was very abrasive, but he was shrewd though, but he would get things done. And so I don't think the fact of his being an immigrant and from far away bothered too many people, but more his personality. But he was able, he's an interesting, very interesting guy, because he was, you'd think in business, you know, you got to be well-liked and, you know, people didn't like him, but he still was able to get things done.
He was an attorney after all. So those rules are a little different.
Were there any particular endorsement deals back then for these guys?
Definitely. You look through as I read through the Miami Herald, you know, the season, a lot of ads, Surrey's Menswear had always had these ads with, Jim Kick and Zonka and Warfield. And, you know, I think there was one with Zonka had sort of this mesh, I don't know, mesh underwear on that it was, you know, but and Paul Warfield in an all white suit. They had deals. Zonka, there's ads of Zonka selling fishing gear, and a lot of them had radio shows. Eight players had their own radio shows, but they were doing a lot. You know, they were a big deal in Miami, not a lot of national stuff, but.
Well, that's what
South
I was curious
Florida,
about. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in South Florida, they were very big. The first national one that I'm aware of is Bob Greasy did this commercial for a laxative. I mean, and he appeared with his mother. There was a television commercial for milk of magnesium or something like that. Wow. But mostly they did a lot of South Florida ads.
Yeah, yeah. They played in the Orange Bowl, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the next professional sports team in Florida would be the Buccaneers in 76 to put a timeline together. Is that right?
That sounds right.
I can't imagine who would have been before that. You know, certainly the NBA, Major League Baseball came very much later. You're 9 years old. That period, you know, third, fourth grade, you're just sort of starting to come into awareness. So you were aware of the team. How aware of this societal backdrop and the conventions and, you know, Vietnam and you know, these other issues were you at the time?
At the time, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, I just remember, I mean, I do remember, but what I remember of the 72 election is my dad, who was, he had never done any kind of political campaigning or anything, but he did volunteer for McGovern and make phone calls and people would say, oh, no, we're for Nixon. And then Watergate was out, you know, and he'd say, but what about Watergate? And no one cared, you know. And they didn't think I was a big deal. And I just remember him. I remember waking up the day after the election. And of course, everyone knew Nixon had no chance of losing that election, despite everything. And we were just talking about Joe Robbie, and Nixon's another guy. People didn't like him personally. Even, you know, he was not well liked, but yet he had quite a remarkable political career. And in 72, the economy was strong and he'd done well with foreign policy, and there was just no chance of him losing. So really, that's the irony of the whole Watergate thing, is there was no need to spy on anybody. He was so far ahead. But that's an interesting story in itself.
Yeah, we've got an entire episode devoted in the archives to the Watergate story and its myriad Florida connections.
Yeah, right.
You know, go back into the archives, all the listeners, and check that out if you're interested in Watergate's specific ties to Florida. And the number of them will blow your mind. What was that? Maybe this past summer, Craig. We did that on summer, the 50th anniversary. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of 50s coming up from 1972. I have to ask you about the craziest thing I read in there, which was about Yeprimian in the Super Bowl. Can you tell that story? So, once again, emphasizing this team had a perfect record. It was not a perfect team by any means.
No, you know, and in fact, most people agree they were better the next year. Next year, they really dominated, even though they lost one game that mattered early in the season to Oakland. But in 72, there were some close games and there were some mistakes made. And this is, of course, the big one in the Super Bowl. They really dominated the Super Bowl, I mean, more so than the two playoff games. And Washington was a very good team. They might have been undefeated themselves. They lost to the Patriots, which was just a crazy game. But they were a great team, and Miami really dominated them in the Super Bowl. And near the end of the game, Garo Yeprimian lined up for a 42-yard field goal that would make the score 17-0. It could easily have been 30-0, to be honest. We can go into that. But this field goal, which he usually would have made, is 42 yards, would make it 17-0. And Joe Robbie was on the sideline saying, it's going to be 17-0 in a 17-0 season. And yeah, that was going to be like a perfect ending. But as you say, it wasn't perfect because the field goal was blocked. It came back to, he made a number of mistakes in the course of 10 seconds. One was kicking the ball so low. The other one was, if you look at the replay, the ball was bouncing right to Earl Morrill, the all-pro the quarterback. It wouldn't have been so bad if Earl Morrill had the ball. But Garrett jumped in front of him and grabbed the ball. And then instead of falling down, he decided he's going to pass it. He saw Zonka downfield and he's going to pass the ball. He threw it and went straight up in the air. When it came back down, when it came back down, he batted it back up in the air like a volleyball. And then finally, Mike Bass of the Redskins grabbed it and ran the other way for a touchdown. And it's 14-7 with 2 minutes left. Mm-hmm. And things became a little tense. To me, and you talk about surprises in my research, the thing that shocked me when I was researching this is when I'm watching through all the games of the season, and 2 months before that, they were playing St. Louis on a Monday night game, not a remarkable game in any way, just a kind of routine win. But in the middle of that game, he did the same thing. Garrett had a field goal blocked. It came right back to him. He tried to throw it with the exact same result. It went straight up in the air. That time, though, a big crowd just jumped on the ball, you know, and so it wasn't as bad. It was just, you know, St. Louis ball. The thing that surprises me so much is that Don Shula, who, as I said, was a master of attention to detail, but he didn't, you know, you would think that Don Shula would have had Garo practicing every day for 15 minutes, blocked field goal, jump on the ball, just fall on the ball. He apparently didn't do that because 2 months later, the exact same thing happened in the Super Bowl. And it could have blown the whole season.
It's one of those great NFL follies, when they used to have those on video cassette back in the 80s that was always on there.
Yes.
Exactly right. Sort of the Benny Hill kind of thing where it's like, what is this person doing? You know, that had occurred in the Super Bowl and was instrumental nearly in the result is astonishing because it looked like a preseason circus routine of a guy who's playing his first NFL game. And that was obviously not the case. The 72 Dolphins continue to have a tradition that infuriates most of the NFL. And that is when the last unbeaten team of each NFL regular season tastes defeat for the first time. They pop champagne bottles and celebrate kind of amongst each other or by themselves. Tell us a little bit about that tradition and apparently the continued, you know, bond now 50 years later that these guys still have.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think that was overblown a little. I mean, I think it wasn't the whole team. It was a few guys. I think it was Dick Anderson and maybe Bonacani and a few. At some point, they would have a little toast when the last team lost. You can't really blame them. If you're part of a group of guys, you know, you're good buddies. Years ago, you did something together that no team had ever done and before and no one has done since. How could there not be some little bit of pride in that and you know, a little bit of celebrating? Sure, when the last team lost, I think if another team had done it, you know, if the Patriots had done it that year, I think they would have been generous in their congratulations. But, you know, it's hard to blame them. And they didn't, you know, they didn't make a big deal out of it, but the story got out. And I think it did. It wasn't very good PR for them. And then it kind of died away, I think, except the funny thing is that Larry Zonka, who kind of, he kind of has said how it's kind of fun being, he says we're like the ghosts that rise up every year. He kind of has fun with it. You know, he thinks it's funny. And so he, the last few years, I noticed on, I guess on Twitter, he will post a little video of himself having a shot of whiskey when not champagne, but whiskey when the last team lost. And he just, to him, it's just kind of funny.
That's great. Why do you think no other team has been able to do that?
Well, you know, before they did it, it was considered impossible in the NFL. In fact, during the year, the guys would talk to each other and say, well, look, we can't, obviously we're not going to go undefeated. No one can go undefeated in the NFL. So which game are we going to lose? And, you know, but they couldn't each week. They said, well, we're not going to lose this week, you know? And so of course, and it came to pass that they did it. It's become harder and harder, you know, as the league made rules to ensure some more parity. They made the seasons longer. Each game you add just mathematically, yeah, makes it much harder to do it. Mm-hmm. And now there's an extra round of playoffs, you know, it's just,
well, it becomes harder, you know, harder. Speaking as someone who's lived in Jacksonville for the past 10 years and I worked in the sports media for 25, it's hard to win an NFL game. And now that the season is longer, the Dolphins won 17 games that year. I believe you would have to win 20 this year. And between injuries and fatigue and the competitiveness of the league, like you mentioned, I mean, it's just it's a damn hard thing to do, evidenced by it only happening once.
Exactly. There's your evidence right there. But even back then, as you say, it wasn't as difficult then, but it was still considered impossible.
Yeah. Well, and even before the NFL was really parity driven and it was only 12 games, you think of the great Packer teams or the Chicago Bears or the Giants, some of these teams that were more on the dynasty side, they never did it in a 12 game regular season with only one or two playoff games. I mean, it's a tough deal. What is the legacy, maybe not specifically of this team, but, you know, of the Dolphins in Miami? What are they? You know, Miami is totally different now. It's a completely international, almost Latin American city, contemporary art, culture, the whole shebang. But the Dolphins are still a big deal.
Yes, and I think because of this thing that happened 50 years ago, that has a lot to do with it. And you know, it may have been obviously there's luck involved. They were lucky, but only one team's ever done it. So it's more than just luck.
I would counter you. I mean, you lose your starting quarterback five games into the season. Luck has just said goodbye.
Luck, exactly. Luck evens out. They had bad luck as well as good luck. But yeah, the fact that they were the ones who did it, I think it still lives. You know, that they had a big ceremony in the stadium this year after the Pittsburgh game. And of course, it's been a long, dry spell for the Dolphins in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. This year, for the first time in since Marino, they had a very exciting team. Unfortunately, the injuries have really put a damper on that. The fact that they're the only team that has done this incredible feat, I think, still lasts with the team and is a source of pride for the city, and that goes on.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, Marshall John Fisher has been our guest. The book released right before the start of this NFL season, 17-0, Miami 1972, and the NFL's only perfect season. There's a link down in the show notes where you can read more about it and purchase the book. Thank you very much, Marshall.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure to be here.
So I have to tell you, I am not and have never been a football fan. Mm-hmm. I'm a baseball guy. But I know the 72 Dolphins. I don't know how I know them, but I know those names. I recognize Larry Zonka, Gary Yeprimian, you know, Bob Greasy. Those are names that I grew up with and I grew up knowing.
Yeah. Well, and again, this you grew up in the panhandle. So you were 500 miles from Florida. So this is obviously, it's not like you were going to games, but, you know, it's still television, the Super Bowl. There aren't many channels. The NFL is on television. And really, since this only undefeated season in NFL history, I dare say most NFL fans today, or certainly who've been fans for several years would know those names because this story always comes back around on every anniversary. And Larry Zonka became a huge celebrity. Bob Greasy from his broadcasting work became a huge celebrity. Mercury Morris was a colorful character. A lot of these people, and again, this John Shula, needless to say, became a big deal. So they were a part of the culture. And, you know, you would have been, you know, growing up in Florida at that time. That's interesting that you remember them despite being so far away and not a football fan.
Yeah, far away, not a football fan. So I tell you that just to set this up, which is at the Miami Book Fair, the last mm-hmm. Miami Book Fair I went to, and they have this area where, you know, sort of like a green room where the authors can hang out and talk to each other and have refreshments. And I see my good friend Dave Barry is mm-hmm. sitting over in a corner talking to this old gray-haired guy. And so I go over and say hello to Dave. And Dave says, oh, and I'd like you to meet my friend Larry Zonka. I'm like, holy cow, I know who you are. just about the stupidest thing you can say. But, you know, there he was. I got to meet Larry Zonka. I knew who he was. So, yeah. You know.
I'm sure you told him, welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.